Blog Talk Radio.
Six Man
Radio.
Bodega, bodega, bodega,
party people, your dreams have now been fulfilled.
Right now you're checking out that Bodega Fresh. Right now you're checking out that Bodega Fresh.
Stand up!
Bodega Fresh Radio, y'all know what it is.
Stand up!
Get your Bodega Fresh on.
Public service announcement for all the people out there listening to this. We will be here forever. Do you understand? Forever.
Bodega. Bodega Fresh with your girl, Nate. Bodega Fresh, your girl, Nate, is back. Welcome. Beginning of fall already. We are the first Sunday of September, and I can't believe it. But, you know, everybody always says, oh, summer's over. I can't believe it goes so fast. It is about 3 months, so it really does go fast. But sometimes when you're young, you really don't realize how fast life is getting at you. And next thing you know, you're an adult, and the world just, you know, going about your life and trying to figure things out. And if you don't already have someone that's been behind you and kind of guided you to where you need to be, it's kind of tough out there as an adult. So today's show, I'm really pushing forward and putting another foot forward for Bodega Fresh by introducing more motivational factors, especially for our people, my black culture, and my kings and queens that are out there living life, maybe struggling. My guest today is actor, motivational speaker, former professional football player, author, and which is the main reason I have him on the show today, Jay Barnett. Jay Barnett, say what's up to the people.
Hey, what's going on? How you doing?
Thank you so much for doing the show. I'm really excited to have you on. Now, we met at the Black Enterprise Modern Men viewing of War Room, you know, and I didn't know about the whole movement about, you know, the VE Modern Men movement. And there was so many different dynamics of beautiful black men there and different elements, finance, entertainment, you know, motivational inspirer was your title. And because of that, I was really, like, I saw you on the screen, and I'm like, oh, my goodness. Of course, the first thought as a woman is like, that's a good-looking man. Man, what's going on here, you know? So, Inspirer, I'm like, he's inspiring people, huh? Well, let me go find out what he's inspiring here. And come to find out, you have currently two books out on the market, and it's called, the first one knowing is Finding Our Lost Kings and Queens, Strategies for Empowering Our Future Kings and Queens. And also you have one directed for the ladies as well. And that title is escaping me, and I apologize for that. But tell them the title about that one, too.
The title of the second book is Letters to a Young Queen. And yes. The subtopic is Redefining Their Throne. And so very excited about that book, and which is also a segue to my boys' book that is coming out in 2016, titled mm-hmm. Hello King. The title of this is Hello King, and the subtitle for that one is Claim Your Throne.
Wow, that is amazing. I'm excited to hear that. I'm just going to, like, start a little from the beginning because, you know, the biggest question is always, you know, when you see a brother and he's doing what he does in this world, you're wondering, you know, what exactly got him to this point, especially you are out there speaking to a certain age frame that a lot of people don't want to deal with, you know, like 13 to 18-year-olds that are out there in the world, lost. Some they don't have their parents and everything like that. So I want to start by saying, you know, you grew up in Mississippi in a small town called Gunnison. I definitely want to hear about Gunnison right now. You got to tell me how it was growing up.
Gunnison is a very small town. It was a very a blue-collar town. Mostly everybody there were sharecroppers. My grandfather was a sharecropper and also an entrepreneur. So he had a small store. Everybody knew everybody. My family were one of the largest families in the town. My dad has seven brothers, three sisters, so it's 11 of them total. So, and most of them were athletes, very athletic, big, strong men. So, you know, they had a name in the town. You know, everybody were fascinated from the Barnett men. You know, they were known as hardworking men. My upbringing was a very good upbringing for the most part in my development years. You know, we was practically raised by my grandmother most of the time because my parents worked a lot. And then my father became a minister, and after becoming a minister, he began pastoring. And so growing up in a small town where everybody knows you has its pros and cons. You know, just as much as everybody know of you, everybody knows your business. So,
right.
You know, that as I grew older, you know, I experienced the consequences of that. You know, because when my parents divorced, you know, it was all over town, and, you know, having to go to school and deal with the ridicule and with the gossip, you know, what happened and what my dad did, you know, a lot of that was very challenging. And
how old were you when that happened?
My parents divorced when I was 13, but their issues started when I was about 7 or 8 and kind of spiraled and kind of, you know, progressed and grew. And I think, you know, now that I look back in, retrospect, is that my parents were young when they got married.
Right.
And I believe that they were two different people that really didn't understand, what they were doing, and I think they grew apart because here my mom was a first lady and being a pastor's wife, and my dad was being a pastor. And I mean, I don't, you know, I look back on it, I don't think they had a clue of what they were doing. And so, you know, they made a lot of mistakes, and they had a lot of trial and error. And just seeing my parents in the beginning of that, you know, being a first family, you know, everybody sort of envied what we had. You know, my dad was pastoring two churches, so, you know, we lived well. And, you know, we had nice things, and we never went without. And all of a sudden, you know, things took a turn for the worse. And watching my father be someone in the pulpit and then another person at home really drove me into a very dark place because I began to see the hypocritical lifestyle of saying one thing and doing another.
Right. So, in the first book that you have out, you do mention, you know, your journey and what brought you to this place. So when that started to happen, you really, you know, while you on one hand wanted to be almost like your father, you wanted to be even better than him, and you had a disdain for him at that time, you know.
Right.
That made you feel as a youth.
Well, you know, for me it was very heartbreaking because, you know, here was a man that I idolized and a man that I just loved and a man that I emulated him very well. You know, I wanted to be just like my dad, you know, He was a great athlete, great football player. He was a great preacher. And, you know, these were all the things that I wanted to become. And after seeing the divorce and how ugly it was and seeing things in the church up, you know, face to face, I really drove me in a dark place because the man that I idolized became a man that I began to hate and resent because of the things that he put my mother through. And it was very difficult to try to understand how all of a sudden things took a turn for the worse. You know, one day we are family, and all of a sudden they're fighting, they're screaming, yelling. So it became chaotic, you know, for us to live in. And, you know, we were a family that was once full of structure, and all of a sudden we were functioning in chaos. And it became the norm.
You have.
I have two sisters, and I'm the oldest. And, you know, my parents divorced, and, you know, my mom moved us to Texas. She left everything behind, the house, and left everything to start a new life. And here we are, going from a house and cars and two-parent household and two incomes to all of a sudden we went to nothing. You know, we were homeless. We were homeless for 3 years. So we struggled a lot. And a lot of that drove me into a deep depression, a deep hate and resentment toward him because, you know, here was a man that preached so hard about families and being the father and being the man that your children needed to see. And he was nothing as what he spoke about. And it never set with me. Because how could you be such a great pastor and such a horrible father and a horrible husband? And
how did that make you feel about God and religion even?
Well,
I had to
bring at that time, you know, at that time, my dad had got me started into youth ministry at an early age. I was speaking to youth at the age of 10, at the age of 9 years old. I was speaking to teens. At the age of 9 and 10, I was teaching, I was preaching, I was traveling. My parents took me to churches to speak. And so, you know, this is not something that I just started. I was a licensed minister by the age of 12. I don't really talk about it because I walked away from God and I forgot about God. I left everything because I was just like, man, how could God let this happen to my family? You know, how could all this stuff go on in the church? And, you know, the hypocrisy that was, you know, that I was seeing, you know, firsthand, it was just like, man, really, is this what God is about? And so it really altered my faith and my belief as a kid. And I had to become the man of the house, and I had to become this backbone for my mother. I had to become this leader, this father, brother, you know. So I had to step into the role, you know, of a father. And I still needed to be, father. And I longed so much for my father to be there, and just, you know, never got the attention, never got the, you know, the pat on the back, the encouragement. And it just drove me into a deeper hole. So one day I looked up, and I became a cutter as a teenager. I became very isolated. I became depressed. Not knowing what the press was, just became quiet, didn't want to talk, didn't want to smile. I wanted to sleep a lot. I hated everybody. You know, I had a lot of anger and not understanding where those things came from. And when you're raised in the church and your spirituality is challenged and you see things too soon, it tends to alter your perspective. And I felt that this whole God thing, this whole family thing, this whole church thing is a load of crap. This is exactly what I felt.
Mhm. Wow, that is already, your journey started so early. Definitely.
Yeah, started.
Like,
yeah,
amazing
man,
that you were teaching the teens at 9 years old. That had to be, something of a phenomenon, especially coming from where you were coming from and then to speak, and had to speak, it must have been very eloquently for a 9-year-old to have people's attention that way. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's probably why you're so... Because when I see you, and then I've watched you, you know, since I met you, I've looked at what you've been doing, watched your YouTubes and everything like that, and I'm like, it's so genuine. Like, how is he so aware of everything like that? He's not that old, you know what I mean? So, you know,
right.
People take it like, you know, he's not that old to be this in tune with how people actually are, you know, especially the youth, you know? So that's amazing.
Right, right.
So, but even through that, you went to college, you graduated with a degree, you did reach, you know, professional, you know, football. So it seemed you still were motivated to take it to the next step, you know, to prove to everybody, I guess, to like, yeah, I am this person and I want to be better than my father, you know. So it seemed like you were still motivated, but in the book you say you were still depressed.
I was still depressed because a lot of it came from, I never had closure, you know, as I was pursuing and as I was driven, because I was driven from pain and I was driven by hurt. And any time that you're driven by pain and hurt, eventually that fuel is going to fizzle out. Because what happened is that place that you're pulling from eventually is going to run dry. And when you don't have a place of passion that you're pulling or that you're driving from, it becomes a drought. Because what happened is that when you're no longer attached to what has hurt you or who has hurt you, now what is the drive? Because all of a sudden, one day I wake up and, you know, I'm looking at, you know, I wanted to go to the NFL, I wanted to go to college. I wanted to do all of these things just to show my dad that says, you know what, I did it, man, without you.
Right.
And when I did it, it still did not render the fulfillment or the satisfaction that I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Because he had moved on. He had remarried. Mm-hmm. You know, he had moved on. And I think a lot of times that what we have to learn is that even when we are hurt, we must heal not only from the people that hurt us, but we must heal from the hurt itself. Because if we don't, we can't keep pulling from that hurt, because it's a place. Keep a home to keep the vibe and to keep that motivation. And what happens is motivation only lasts for a moment.
Right.
And it has to be something that inspires you to go beyond what was or what did cause that pain. And so it wasn't until one day that I had a conversation and I asked God, you know, why did you allow me to get to the NFL and you did not allow me to really, you know, taste, you know, you gave me this appetizer, but I wasn't able to, you know, enjoy the entree. God says, because you wanted it for the wrong reason. And he says, you wanted it to prove a point. You wanted it to show and put it in his face. But he says, I need you to understand that the man that you are resenting is that you are hating a man that can't be no more than what you can be. Because he says, you upset him because he wasn't a perfect father. And I wasn't. And so I struggled with unforgiveness and I struggled with resentment. And I was still battling, like, why can't I move forward? Why am I still unhappy? You know, I was the first. My dad has other kids. And so it's a total of 7 of us. And the other 2 or 3 are older than I am. And so, and then you have the 3 by, you know, my mother. And so I'm the first out of all of these kids who graduate and go to college and, you know, do all these great things. This man has never said, I was proud at this time. He's never said, he just, good job. And I'm like, dude, what the hell, man? And then I realized, and it wasn't until I was talking to my pastor, and he said, son, your dad can't give you no more than what he has. And that's when I started to understand, and my heart began to soften. And I began to understand that you can't expect anybody to operate and function in the capacity in which they don't have the ability to do.
Right.
And so what happened is that this passion to help build young kings and queens through my books and through my message came from my mother, because she had no understanding what being depressed meant, what mental illness was. All she knew was just to pray. She didn't know how to deal with it, but all this time she kept telling me, Jay, you're born to be great, son. You're a king. And I had no clue what that meant.
Right.
And I had no clue that it meant that I was still in control in spite of everything. And I didn't understand that passion and that drive that I had for football, I had to learn how to channel it for something else positive to benefit more than just myself. Because football benefited me. What I do now benefits others. So my journey, even though it has been a challenging one, a difficult one, surviving two suicide attempts, being depressed most of my teen years up into my mid-20s, you know, and really coming out of that and really exposing the truth about mental illness in the Black community as an African-American man, as an athlete, as a man of masculine structure. Like, it was very pivotal that I exposed that to shed light to help other people, because what I realized is that so many teens were struggling, because when my parents divorced, that epidemic started. The baby boomers at that time, most of the kids that I grew up with, most of their parents are not married. So it was just like a wave. It was like a wave just hit. You know what I mean? And it was just like everybody just started getting divorced. It's just like, what the heck?
And then the whole term of baby mama, or, you know, my baby daddy, that whole era that came is really crazy. It seemed like, I don't know, like a systematic plan almost, because it was such a big wave. And what shifted? Like, I had a conversation, so I'm like, what shifted in our culture where the whole family structure was a thing that fell apart? And it lasted for so long. Like, what exactly shifted? Do you have any ideas on that?
You know, I believe what happened is that nobody had any knowledge of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had any skills to be married. And I think a lot of them were emulating what they saw their parents do. You know, when I look at my parents, you know, and I look at where I am today in this generation, you know, the baby boomers were really a byproduct of the generation that had worked and slaved, and, you know, they had fought through, you know, racism, they fought through the whole civil rights movement, and finally, you know, with my parents, you know, you had that breakthrough that everybody was able to get credit. Everybody was able to start making a little more money. Everybody was starting to progress a little bit. And so what happened is, I think, you know, as we progress in all these other areas, we didn't grow, you know, mentally. We didn't grow, you know, as far as developing as individuals. And what happened is everybody knew how to have a wedding, but nobody knew how to be married. And so, and that's what I look at.
Still stands to this day. That still stands to this day. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, and it's funny, me and my mother talk about it all the time. And I look back and she was just like, Jay, you know, me and your dad, you know, we didn't have a clue. you know, all we knew is that, you know, we were young, 23, 24, you know, and we didn't know what we were doing. And I think there wasn't as much available as resources and as material, as practical tools that were available for them to learn how to build a family. So you had people married 10, 15 years and all of a sudden they was walking out. And the result of it was that the kids were broken.
Right.
And so a lot of these broken kids never got fixed, because what you don't repair, you will repeat. So, and you have a lot of my generation that are repeating the same thing. And broken parents raise broken children. And you have this epidemic to where nobody understands how to build anything in a family structure. And so it's created this self-gratification mentality across, you know, society. And I feel like with my message and what I'm doing, if I can grab them at that age that I needed guidance, that I needed the attention, that I needed the development. Because in those 13 through 17 years, those are pivotal years, because you still have a sponge-like mind, and whatever you are, whatever somebody's pouring into you and whatever somebody's feeding you, that is what you're going to ultimately become. So if I can catch them at that age and change their perspective and change how they see things, that will alter their choices on who they choose as spouses, who they choose to hang with, who they choose to become. Allow them to see the options that are available instead of taking what is, you know, presented to them. And that's my mission, you know, when I get before these teens. And I'm so aware, because nothing has changed as far as the dynamics of brokenness, because teens want attention, and not attention to say that I need to be seen, but they want somebody to care.
Right.
And I believe that is the uniqueness that I have when I'm speaking to them. They can feel the genuine, you know, interest and the compassion that I have for what I do. And it's not something that I'm doing just to, you know, be seen, or doing just to say, hey, I work with kids. Because I remember when I first started this, man, it was two kids that I was working with. I was working with three boys, two white guys, two white boys, and a black kid. And all of a sudden, I look up, it's 10 kids, and all of a sudden, I look up, I'm working with 50 kids, and it was just kept growing. And it wasn't until one day I was out here in Texas and I was working with six kids. I was driving about almost an hour to work with six kids, mentoring them and developing them and working on their physical and mental capacity. And we're outside and, you know, we're working out and, you know, talk to these kids. And I'm just like, God, really? Six kids? And something said, look out there. I said, God, I just drove almost an hour for six kids. And something said, I need you to look out there again. And when I looked, I saw a field of kids everywhere. And when I saw these kids standing there, God said, now you're seeing with a different eye. Because what you're seeing now is vision. Look at those. You being able to see those six kids is a function of sight. You seeing those multiple kids standing in the hundreds is a function of vision. So that's when I started to grasp the concept. Said, okay, God, this is where you're calling and pushing me to. Because he took what I began doing as a kid and brought it full circle back to I was an adult. And he said, I would never let what happened to you move further than where you're going to go, because I need you to stay connected to the hurt and pain. It does not feel the same, but I need you to stay connected to it so you can know how to recognize it when you see it. And that is what keeps what I do authentic.
Some of the things I want to read, some of the things that people have described your book, Finding Our Lost Kings, and also Letters to a Young Queen. One person said, I almost cried, but held back. So moving and inspirational. Another person said, not your typical inspirational book. Definitely a powerful message. A must read. Another person said it was mind blowing. And one last one, and you know, I don't mean to toot your horn, but you know, even my friend Santree Simon, who has a son who's 13 now, she's bought the book for him, and he's told his friend about it. For kids
wow.
at that age to tell their friends, hey, you need to read this book at that age, it speaks to what you're doing. And, you know, how does that make you feel when kids are saying that? Like, I told my friend to read the book. It changed my life.
To be honest, oh, my gosh, it's so humbling because it's a feeling that I can't explain. It leaves me speechless every time because I think back to those times where I was getting ready to take my life, and I felt like I was very insignificant in being on the face of the earth. And, mm-hmm. you know, felt as if I had no value or had no reason to be alive. And to see, you know, what I have done and what I'm doing, and to see how it's impacting these kids. Because to me, every young boy I ever met, I see so much of myself in them. You know, whether it's the kid without the dad, it's the kid that's trying to fit in, or the kid that, you know, he's smart, but he dumbs himself down when he gets around his friends. And it's like, even I see a lot of myself in the girls, you know, you have that look, you like, you just, you know, you're scared. You don't know. You want to be loved. You want somebody to reach out. You want somebody to care. So when I hear kids speak of my book like that, it's just, it keeps me, you know, very humble, and keeps me very, sincere, or sensitive to the will of God and his call. And it also reminds me that God has kept his word,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he and I, you know, we did, make a deal, I sort of put, you know, some pressure on him. I'm like, yo, you know, I told him, I said, listen, if I'm going to stay here, what am I going to do?
Mm.
And I never forget him saying, and I'm hearing a voice saying, that I'm going to take you places that the NFL could have never taken you. And if you just give me a chance, I'm going to turn this thing around. And I remember till this day crying and hearing the voice of the enemy saying, don't believe that. But then, on one end, hearing God say, hey, just trust me. And this battle was going on literally in my room in front of my bed as I'm sitting there cutting on myself. And I'm just like, and so much of me, I mean, like, wanted to just die and end it. But then there was a small part of me that just said, hey, let's just live a little longer just to see what happens.
Right.
You know, and it's just, when I hear these kids, man, it really brings joy to my heart and to my soul that what I'm doing is going to live, is going to outlive me, because this book will continue to move from hand to hand, from boy to boy, girl to girl, and it will continue to impact lives. And it's just, it's a blessing, because I could not have written this up, because if it was left up to Jay, and I tell people this, I'm very honest, I was a kid, I was convinced that I was going to die early.
Right.
I was convinced. And I was okay with that. I mean, I was a kid that, I mean, death, talking about death was common. I'm a writer, and I wrote about death often. I wrote about flying, and I wrote about disappearing. And, I mean, you know, my writing was very dark. It was very close. You know, didn't want to open up to anybody. And, you know, when I hear a kid says, you know, I'll pass the book to my friend, it's just, leaves me speechless.
Yeah. I mean, when I started, you know, just researching for this interview, and then I saw her, you know, we were just recently talking, and, you know, she posted to Instagram about the book. And then, you know, she said something about the book. I had a picture of her son with his friend. And when she posted it, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm interviewing him on Thursday. Did you meet him? She's like, no, I bought my son the book. And I'm like, really? You know, so to me, it was almost like, you know, I was meant to speak with you. Because when I see things happen like that, it seems like, you know, it's not random to me that, you know, someone I happen to know that wasn't there when I met you is also speaking of you. You know, it's amazing to see. So I know that you are definitely making strides, especially with that age from 13 to 18. I have to, you know, do a little confession myself. When I was younger, I did a stunt in foster care. You know, I was really young. I was 6, but from 6 to about 13, it was rough for me. And I was lucky when I got into a certain foster home where this beautiful woman, loving woman, who was at this huge house. You know, I went from living in, you know, more of an urban area to this gigantic home where I had my own room and all these clothes, and I thought it was an amazing thing. And at first I was so upset, like, why? You know, why am I here? I want to be with my parents, you know. But, you know, even from that break, coming back into life with my parents from 13 to 18, it wasn't great. They didn't stay together. 3 years later from coming back at 13, they were divorcing, you know. So it was just rough for me. And I wish that someone like you had written a book like that, that I could read, that I knew that I was worthy of something, because I definitely felt lost, you know. So that age frame is, a lot of people do not want them. A lot of them get timed out of the foster care system. You're doing such great work. You have two programs, the Me Project and Beast Mode. I don't know if you're still doing Beast Mode as well. I want you to talk about those programs.
Most definitely, we still do Beast Mode in the summertime for our kids that are athletes. But the bulk of our work is coming through the Me and the We Project. And we're actually relaunching the program again for a girls program that we're going to start here. And I've been mentoring girls, and we've actually been, you know, functioning in our girls program here. But both of those programs that we've taken in various arenas in the school setting, and it just came out of the foster homes. And so I've just been blessed with such a unique gift to be able to reach boys and girls, to be able to do a lot of emotional rebuilding, a lot of mentally rehab, you know, for these kids, really tearing down those walls that they've built up and helping them rebuild healthy, you know, walls, because we all need walls, you know. It's just the type of wall that you're building up. And so, you know, just really helping these kids redefine who they are, speaking life into them, working with them very intensely, working with them in such a very powerful way, getting them to open up and to talk about the hurt, the pain, the abandonment. They talk about the resentment and the anger, and a lot of the issues that they've been closed about. You know, some of them talk more to me than they do to their caseworkers, because they're able to see, you know, the the impact and to see the heart and the passion behind what I do, because I tell them all the time, I can't free you. I can only provide you with the tools to free yourself. But when you show them the benefits of being free, they're engaged. Mm-hmm. See, the issue with most people that are working with teens, they don't show them the benefits of becoming a new person because they're so heavily, you know, into telling them you need to be a new person, but tell me why. Because, see, once you explain the why to me, now I see the value. Because, see, if I don't know the why, then I'm not going to, you know, value the information that you're giving me. Because, see, if I don't know the purpose of good credit, I won't understand why I need to have good credit. So we have to be able to provide them with not only the tools, but provide them with the benefits that the tool gives them. And that's what I'm able to do on all levels, and whether it's a black kid or white kid. Our program reach a variety of kids from different social economic groups and backgrounds, and, you know, very diverse program. And it's growing. And my vision has always been to take this program and this movement globally, because I want to reach as many kids as I possibly can, because I believe that one can chase away 1,000 and two, 10,000. And with that being said, is that every one kid that I come in contact with, that I change for the better to be a king, or every young girl that I'm challenging to be a queen, as you said, with these kids that are telling their friends about this book, we're impacting lives beyond ourselves. And that's what it's really about.
Yes, it is. That's really what it's all about. Books that I've read to try to motivate me to put myself in a different mind frame always say the same thing. It's not about what you can do for yourself and make yourself you know, wealthy or rich. It's about what you can contribute back and help others. And when you help others, it just magnifies right back onto you and builds you up even more. And that is the key. Basically, you know, and you have to care about people. You have to care about your earth. There's so many elements to the life that we're living where people have just seemed to become in this day and age just careless and just very ignorant of what this life should be. And it's really a scary feeling almost to me, you know, the things that happen with social media and all the things that we're hearing, and especially, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and things that are happening with police brutality that have really always been happening, but it seems to be so much more awareness now. Where do you see yourself going? And do you see yourself remaining and speaking to the youth? Or do you feel like you'll also speak to parents and, you know, maybe possibly in the footsteps of Dr. Umar Johnson of Hidden Colors?
I really believe that, you know, I'm going to transcend eventually into working with parents and to developing parents, mothers and fathers, because I think the key component or the key element to building strong children is making sure we build those that create these children. And if you want to know the maker, if you want to know what a thing is going to become, go back to what created it. And so we can change and redirect the path of a lot of our children if we work on the parents. And most of the parents have not had any development and have not had the proper teaching or education or enlightenment on how to parent. And as I've already started here in creating workshops for parents, it's not about telling them how to parent, but it's providing them with the tools that will make them effective parents and to parent on purpose. And so in the next 2 to 3 years, I see myself traveling globally and with these workshops and with these events and seminars, in sharing my message and sharing my intellectual property on how I've been so successful with reaching teens from all walks of life and how I'm able to break the codes that everybody else feels that it's difficult to break. And it's not. And it's learning how, one, to listen without speaking and seeking to understand instead of seeking to be understood. And so if most parents could adopt those two practices, you know, you'll be along a lot further, because it's removing yourself from the situation and seeing, okay, what is it that my child needs and what is it that I can give them? Because these kids are, they're faced with a whole lot more than you or I were faced with when we were kids because of the speed of information, because of this, you know, this wave of social media, the rapid technology, you know, with information traveling as fast and with everything being uploaded by the moments and by the second. And so with this wave, and so it's very important that, you know, someone is able to teach people how to manage all of this.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not about, yeah, it is. It can be very overwhelming, and it can be very overwhelming for a parent to the point to where they just say, hey, listen, man, do what you want. And that's almost where we're at right now, because parents don't parent anymore. You know, they're just buying food and paying for a roof over their head. They're not really parenting. And I tell parents all the time, your child is a reflection of you. You know, no matter how I go, I can tell what you're doing and what you're saying, because it's going to come out of him or her.
Now, what kind of message would you give a person that has struggled and such as yourself, maybe never had any closure with their father, you know, their father being absent and out of their lives, and now they're an adult, kind of still struggling?
Well, the key to closure is understanding that forgiveness is not for that other person. Forgiveness is for you. And there's something that I live by, that there's nothing worse than remembering something that you can't change.
Right.
And by remembering and reliving it over and over and over and over, you're going to live a great amount, or you're going to have a great amount of stress and anxiety over your life. And you have to free yourself from the hurt, from the pain. It's never easy. Will you forget? No. It's similar to if you fail and you cut yourself and you had to get stitches. For that moment, you're in pain. After the stitches, it still hurt. But over time, that pain eventually goes away. Now, that scar will remain, and you're going to be reminded of the incident that happened, but that pain is no longer there. So the same is that the scars may be still there of what happened, what was said, what was done. Either you were violated, you were abused physically, sexually, emotionally, whatever, and all of it is very unfortunate. But it's what is unfortunate is that you don't check out of your life because of what somebody else decided to do. Because we can't control what our parents do, who done it to us, but what we can control is how we move on from it. And being victim is easy. Being the victor is hard. Because being the victor means that I have to move beyond what was.
Right.
And what happened. And it's difficult. And I tell people is think about what life do you want to live beyond what has happened? Because sometimes we hold the keys to our own prison.
Yes. Yes, we do.
Because that individual has moved on. That individual has, you know, probably forgotten about it, and, you know, and my thing is, don't imprison yourself off of somebody else's crime. You know, right. and it's important that you free yourself. And free yourself by what I have my kids do is that one of the exercises, I have them write a letter to the individual. And sometimes that letter may not get to that individual. Yeah. But what you're doing is you're freeing your spirit from it. I had a young lady that mother got her hooked on cocaine and crack. And, you know, she's in foster care, been in foster care for the past 4 years because of it. And, she, you know, when we started, she was very adamant about, you know, holding on to it and not letting it go. And when I told her, I said, listen, I'm sorry that your mother did that. I'm sorry that she was irresponsible. I'm sorry that she didn't care enough about you and to be a mother for you. But I said, what I can't be sorry for is I can't be sorry for how you're going to let this affect you for the rest of your life. Because, see, what the victim does is the victim says, this happened to me, don't expect any much more of me. And then the victim oftentimes get with people that support their actions or why they do what they do because of what happened. But so what I'm here to inform you is that that may have happened, but the truth is that you can live beyond that. Because some of the greatest people had to overcome some of the greatest and difficult challenges to be who they were. Not because they had it easy, but because they chose to move beyond what happened. And when you break it down to those kids, and you help them to understand that there's life beyond the situation, man, it changes their perspective. And this girl now, I mean, she is, she's getting ready to go to college. Her life, I mean, you cannot tell her she's not a queen. You can't tell her she's not going to make it. Because I took the time to break down those walls. And you don't have to break down those walls by yelling, by screaming, and all these weird methods and all of these different, you know, stuff that people think that you got to do and kumbayas and all of that, man. All it is that you have to show them what it looks like. Because as kids, what I learned as a kid, we become what we see.
Yes, we do.
And if you show me how to win in a losing situation, I never lose a day of my life. Because I'm going to learn how to walk away with a winning attitude even when I have to take a loss. And that's what it's about. So I would say to those individuals, to that young man or to that young lady, free yourself. Don't live in a jail that you didn't build.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank Jay Barnett for coming on to the show today. Two books that are out, the latest one, Letters to a Young Queen, Redefining Their Throne, and also Finding Our Lost Kings and Queens, Strategies for Empowering Our Future Kings and Queens. I highly recommend you buy the book for your child. Read the book yourself because it's quite inspirational, and the message itself, it transcends more than just the youth, even though that's who you're definitely grasping for. But, you know, just by the descriptions that I've read, it must be so powerful and amazing. Yeah, I'm ready to read it myself, you know, because, you know, just from reading the part, you know, where you go, my story is short. And, you know, I was just amazed by that. But even talking to you and knowing that you've been doing this since you were 9, the experiences, the things that you've seen, and being from Mississippi as well, and experiencing like this generation of sharecroppers, that had to be a heavy influence on you as well. So I'm definitely going to keep following you and supporting the things that you do. You're motivating me to be, you know, more than what I'm doing as well, and I'm happy to have met you. You guys, I want you to support him. His website is j-barnett.com. You can find out so many other elements to Jay, as well as acting. Now, I didn't get to touch on that, but, you know, I feel like this message that you have right now is just overpowering that right now, you know.
Right, yes.
I did see that you were doing a little acting. You were kind of on a reality series and things like that. But, ladies and gentlemen, what he's doing right now is what you need to support and follow what he's doing. He's on YouTube. I saw that Tom Joyner reached out to you, so you are doing amazing things, and I hope you come back on the show again whenever you feel like speaking. I definitely want to have you back on the show on a panel that I want to put together and just speak about certain elements that are, you know, impacting our youth that have to do with hip-hop and things. So I hope you be able to do that, and I hear you're going to be back in New York real soon, so looking forward to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well.
Yes, thank ma'am.
Thank you
for having me. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Don't hang up, because I definitely want to get a drop from you. Ladies and gentlemen, Nadine Michelle Bodega Fresh will be back.
Memories, drawing corners with the folds in the mold. Watch out the store for the gold, talking straightforward to hoes. Got uncles that smoke and some for blow up their nose to cope with their load. The wind is cold and it blows. In they socks and they souls, niggas holding their gold. Corners leave souls open and closed, hoping for more, but nowhere to go. Niggas rolling in droves, they shoot the wrong way cause they ain't knowing they goes. The street ain't safe cause they ain't knowing the cold. By the foes, I was told, either focus or fold. Got cousins with flows, hope they open some doors so we can got clothes and roll in the road. Now I roll in the O's with windows that don't roll. Down the road with cars get broken and stole. These are the stories told by Stony and Cotty Grove. The world is cold, the block is hot as a stove. On and on. I wish I could see this feeling. I wish I could see this feeling. On the corner, niggas crying, niggas killing, dying just to make a living. Educated, the corner was our time. When time stood still and gators and stations and yellow and pink and color blue profiles glorifying the street lights and deep nights. Cats trying to eat right, riding no seat bikes with work to feet height so they can keep sweet nights. They head in their feet right, desires of street life, cars and recites. It's hard to breathe night, days are seats like the beast roaming streets. The police is weak like game at its peak. We speak and believe tight. Bang in the streets, that cop left a deep right. It's deep life, coming up with niggas and sheep like. Rappers and hoopers, we strive to be like. Cheese with three stripes, cheese and knee flight. Cheese and weed sight, knees and deep strikes. The corner, we struggle and grief fight. We write songs about wrong, cause it's hard to see right. Look to the sky, hoping it will bleed like. Reality's a bitch, and I heard that she fight. The corner, I wish I could see this thing. I wish I could see this feeling. On the corner, niggas cry, niggas killing, dying just to make a living. From the go where it's still, hoes go for the kill. Streets cold blooded for real, hope you're holding it still. Cause Joe's fold under pressure and squeal. Small time dealers and kingpins. Sing when pigs cut them a deal. So many sold, they sold for a pill. Blowing back dope stacks and quote raps. Wish I could give you this feel. Bond hurt him for certain reasons, only Jesus can heal. Murder is permanent, no turning back from the killing field. Buildings with bullet holes, no loyalty here. Just lost children, stamped for the slaughter, consider a feel. We make it bang, y'all resample the steel. South side, we be outside with a payphone. Slanging them skills on the corner, corner, corner. On the corner, niggas cry, niggas killing, dying just to make a living.
The corner.
Bodega Fresh, your girl Nadine. Oh man, that was such a great interview with my guest tonight, Jay Barnett, author, motivational speaker, also actor, played professional football for the NFL and also arena football. There's two books that are out, Letters to a Young Queen, Redefining Their Throne, and Finding Our Lost Kings and Queens, Strategies for Empowering Our Future Kings and Queens, is just a must-have amongst the 12 to 18-year-old set. And my girlfriend, Santry Simon, brought the book for her son. She's also read the book for Letters to a Young Queen. It's a very powerful book. I mean, some of the descriptions I read in the interview are just true to form. If you go to Amazon.com, you can find both books there. He is currently right now at the Tom Joyner family reunion. So I know he's definitely crushing it out there and giving his motivational speaking and also slamming with some poetry. He's a real powerful poet. The man is an ordained minister since the time he was 12, so definitely want to thank again Jay Barnett for coming on to the show. You guys support him. He's doing such great things with our youth. And this is the first in a series of conversations I'm going to have leading up to the Million Man March. That's right. This year is the 20-year anniversary of the Million Man March, and that is happening October 10th in Washington, D.C. I'm going to try to make it out there. It's going to be bananas. Minister Farrakhan is definitely on top of the game. He has a Facebook out right now. It's called 20-Year Anniversary of Million Man March. Check it out. And everybody's going to be there. It's going to be phenomenal. I can't believe it's been 20 years. I don't feel that old. And I was going to say it, I'm not that old. So 20-Year Anniversary of Million Man March. A slew of speakers are going to be there. But you guys definitely follow me through that. My next show is on September 20th, and I'm not going to tell you right now who I'm going to bring. I'm going to keep it a surprise. But look out. Check me out on Facebook, Nadine Michelle, and also Bodega Fresh Radio on Facebook as well. You got to check that out. So couple of things. This is Labor Day weekend. You guys out in Brooklyn tomorrow, be safe during that parade. Let's like get through that day without any fatalities. This weekend is shaping up to be a little crazy already, so let's try to keep everyone safe out there in Brooklyn, Bucktown. Let's calm down out there, all my Haitian massive, all my people, my cousins, Mimi, my cousin Mimi, happy birthday. Want to shout out my cousin Mimi. I had to say that. Happy birthday to you, baby girl. Be safe out there. I don't think you guys go to parade, but be safe regardless. And let's see, one of the things I wanted to play before I get out of here, and it is definitely a little something about the book Letters to a Young Queen, Redefining Their Throne. Understand, ladies, a lot of us men and women, boys and girls, go through so much drama. And our focus is just nowhere to be seen. And when we don't know what our path is and we don't plan and try to reach our goals, then our life kind of becomes chaotic. You know, you're leaving it up to chance, and you should never leave your life up to chance. You are the director of your life. You should definitely sit it out, plot it out. You're the star. It's like you're the movie star. And everyone in front of you is your audience. And all you got to do is direct yourself properly, and you will become a magnificent star of your own film, your life, you know? So check out those books. And I'm going to get into a little Dope Girl Magic by my girl, Book Brown, featuring Invincible and Star, you guys. October 10th is the Million Man March. Happens to also be the A3C Festival. But Million Man March, take precedence to that. I'm also working on something really, really great. I'm going to tell you guys about it. It's coming up in November. I got something cooking for you guys. But tune in to the next show, September 20th. I'm going to get into this Dope Girl Magic. Book Brown, y'all. It's Bodega Fresh. I'll be back September 20th, your girl Nadine, and I'm out. Bye.
Abracadabra, waving the wand of gray matter, watching your thoughts scatter overhead like Mad Hatter. Darkness being masked and you haphazard, kill the dramatic, fakeness repel automatic, Jones and for clones and when your dome closed in. You trapped in the square, I got Bahama breeze in my hair. Just cool, bust fools like Piñata. Mentally, all that is dope, I am attention. Metaphor, juju, lyrical voodoo. Phillips drive, screw you, we done off the one off. No hit, wonders, blunder, hat trick, slice a hand. Flow, excite your fam, dope girl, just catch your fan. Yup, yup, it's like that, some rumba, she fight back. Have my way with the tracks and I fade into black. Sweeter than cake cups, smearing they makeup. Ringing them bells like that, what kind of stuff?
Grab the mic and rock a rhyme, so I savage. How I do it, I'm a dope.
Mama's house got put out with a vagabond. Roam the streets with lyric sheets and microphones with magic bombs. Turned out it's the Euros, haters to comp and heroes. Nah, I wasn't perfect, but this ain't a tragic song. What? Shoulder height, going to open mics if some rack was on. Snatch it out the hand, go, go, get the arm. Next thing you know, the cord is shortest with thanks to a sorceress. Higher force, fed me fire torches, I was forceless. Hear the truth and nothing but it. Uncensored by any corporate endorsements. Till the dude stops to ignore the exist. Don't mean we don't exist, just cause you ain't aware of us. Like the sound it makes when a falling tree in the forest hits. Aquarius who sprinkles fairy dust over the snare drum. Turn up from a track to a classic like metamorphosis. Telling me to feel, I blast like felons with a Nina. Start inhaling since some Mia put a spell on you like Nina. Yeah,
grab the mic and rock a rhyme, so fast. How I do it, I call it dope rattle. My ass rock a rhyme, quick rhyme, so fast. How I do it, call it dope girl. Grab the mic and rock a rhyme, how I'm so fast.
On them ease through the scene. On some she's gotta have it. Like a fiend with a habit. Tight dreams. Got me leaning to the side. Eyes glassy. And they ask me how you stay so fly. Told them I'm a sea line woman. How I breathe like the summer carefree. I don't wonder about a thing. Just breathe on it. Ease on it like the green. When I teef on that thing. And I sip upon a team. And a thing from it. Let the bullshit breathe. Watch it fall like the leaves. After spring, I'ma stay doing queen things. And I represent accordingly. Can't afford to be concerned about a glass ceiling. It's the hill and fill it. Basically, what you pay to be, naturally given. Practically limitless. Warrior woman, trace back to the genesis. Royal the lineage. Know that it's infinite. All in the spirit. I'm living it. Get it? Breathe.
Grab the mic and rock a rhyme. So savage. Rocking with the bad. Dope, dope, girl, man. Get up. Let it knock. Top, top, count class. How I do it.
From Gabu with a nostrum, some that indict me. You hear the sound, see the flash like thunder and lightning. Tears drop like rain. The block stay on fire like the pavement on a hot day. It's Friday, beginning of the weekend, late night. We out here slinging while you sleeping. Dominicans and Puerto Ricans, Jamaicans and Haitians, man, it's all the same shit. We came on a slave ship, we trapped in the trap. 2009, nigga, no matter the year, we stay on the grind, nigga. Calling ourselves bossing up. But we still in the field like Jeter. The crackers is time, Brenner, my mind clearer. I see the game for what it is. It's more than life than chasing paper. Ducking these fucking pigs. These motherfuckers ain't even on my level. That's bullshit, yeah, though. Yeah, speaking of the devil.
No flash, born to clash. I'm story headline, all the days of time.
They say the chief of the tribe took a handsome bribe. Now it's bitch everywhere and he hard to find. Super prime on the grind and I'm out of times. You can gain the whole world and just lose your mind. Now younger, you can hug the block, but it don't hug back. When it do, with a squeeze, your spine goes snap. Like these chase paper till they lungs just collapse. Ain't no freedom at the trap, it's as simple as that. Play a hater, no mind, they don't matter. And while we're slaves, you can just kill masters. Slaves getting brave to guard masters' interest. The nades who can feel it when I snap the clip and flap. It's not a threat, that's an oak. Get well, a cat shell shop over, get a dose. It's New York hours, baby, we never close. And however the banks go, my brother. silence don't broke this smoke.
No slash,
born to clash, top story headline, all the days of time.
Top story
headline, all the days. So let me tell you about America, the plantation. It's about to burn like terror did it. Going with the wind, that's why they going in. They know the end is near. Israel is about to disappear. Man, listen here, you better get prepared. They going all out. They prepared to bring the nukes out and take us all out with the fallout. Until then, they got the dogs out, sniffing for felonies. From here to Tel Aviv, across the seven seas. They starting new world order. Fam, I'd rather drink my own urine than drink this New York water. Cause that's suicide. I'm telling what it's doing to your insides. They got me salty like the Mickey D's French fries. They got your pressure high and pressure bust pipes. We all screwed and I ain't talking about I love life. But through it all, I still love life. I'm still optimistic, trying not to be a statistic. America,
no slash,